Perfect Stranglers contains graphic and explicit content suitable for mature listeners. Listener discretion is advised.
So this episode of Perfect Stranglers contains graphic depictions of rape, torture, and abuse, along with suicide. Generally, we put down the disclaimer before we start, but we wanted to add an extra disclaimer here because this episode is especially graphic. So listener discretion is advised. Hey, everyone. Welcome to Perfect Stranglers. I'm your host, Kylie.
And I'm Bree.
How the hell are ya? Still suffering from seasonal depression over here. How about you, Bree?
Oh, definitely. They have optional overtime for work, and I've been doing like an extra hour each night just to, you know, get a little bit extra cash. I don't think I can do it tonight. I don't think I can do it.
No, this is a lot.
Yeah.
Recording's a lot.
Yeah.
And it doesn't take us nearly as long as it used to. We've got a pretty good process down. But sometimes it's, when we're recording three episodes, sometimes it takes like 4 hours.
Yeah.
And it's just, it's a lot. It's a lot, especially after talking all day, you know?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't talk all day, but.
So this... You yeah, do. I talk to myself all day because I'm a psycho. my mom's like, nobody's surprised. Did you know when I was in elementary school, the teachers all told me, used to tell like my reports and stuff, my report cards, all that stuff, and when you do conferences, they would say how quiet and behaved I was.
Oh, yeah. That's what mine said, too.
Yeah. Yep. And then I would get home and just not fucking shut up. I would just not shut up. And now I like think back to it and I'm like, well, it's because I was so insecure to like say anything because I didn't want to get made fun of because I was getting made fun of so much at home by my brother and stuff.
Oh,
and yeah. By like my cousins. I'm getting real deep here that I just didn't want to say anything. And to this day in social crowds, if I'm around like 10, 15 people at a party, I won't talk. But if you put me on stage in front of like 500 people, I'm golden because there's bound to be at least one person that likes me.
True.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So this episode comes out on November 11th, and I feel like this is a really good time to discuss Thanksgiving food.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So give me your top three Thanksgiving foods and the one that you think is trash.
Okay. Top three Thanksgiving foods. The sweet potatoes are number one for me.
With, like, the marshmallow, the yes. Whole sitch?
Okay. Oh, yeah. Brown sugar.
Okay.
All of that.
Yep.
Mashed potatoes, number two. And number three, some people are going to be like, are you kidding me? What about stuffing? What about the turkey? What about... But I'm going to say for number three, canned cranberry sauce.
Mom, you hear that? You got Bree's a fan too.
I like the canned. All right.
So. Okay. And what's like the it. One that you're like, this is trash? Why are we even doing this?
Stuffing. Yuck. It's like.
Have you ever had cornbread stuffing?
Maybe. But like, it's my really mom good. Used to make this stuffing that had like raisins and like white people shit in it. Like. You know what I mean? No, like.
Yeah. Yep.
It's like. Stuffing is like you cleaned out the scrapings on the bottom of your oven and you just like swept all the stuff from on top of the counter. That's what stuffing is like to me.
Okay.
It's gross.
Can I tell you my hot take on Thanksgiving?
What's that?
I'm always good for a hot take. I hate Thanksgiving. I hate the food. I hate the holiday. I think it's pointless. I wish we would do something else with that day.
Yeah.
Growing up, my Thanksgiving food was all beige. We never made any of the fun stuff. It was very much white people Thanksgiving. It was, no offense, Mom, but nobody makes it. I make a great turkey, but that's because I use like 10 sticks of butter. But it was like dry turkey or ham, but usually it was turkey. And then it was the stuffing, but my mom would cut up the giblets and put the giblets in it. And that's just like, it's like, like, walk, why?
See?
And I think she stopped me that eventually. Yeah, yes, I know, okay. With the stuffing, it was beige, and then the mashed potatoes were beige, and then one time Anthony kept the skins on and made like chunkier mashed potatoes, and my mom flipped shit on him, like, you're supposed to peel them, and he still brings that up to me around this time of year, and we're divorced. Wow. And he still says it.
Yeah, no, my mom puts skins on them when she's feeling lazy, and then she'll be like, there's so much nutrition in the skins.
Yep.
You know?
Yep. And then it was always in like, yeah, the beige stuffing, beige mashed potatoes, beige rolls. Corn is like yellow, but like not bright yellow. It's like beige corn. Everything is beige. It's boring. You know what I wish we would have had at Thanksgiving? Fucking mac and cheese.
Mac and cheese, right?
And we never had sweet potatoes because my mom didn't like sweet potatoes. So if I were to remake my Thanksgiving, this is what I would fucking have. I would have bomb ass mac and cheese.
Yeah.
I would have pulled pork sandwiches.
Okay.
Okay. With a pretzel bun.
Yeah.
Okay. And then I would have sweet potatoes with I like that. Sweet potatoes. That's good. And then rolls would be good, but like chips would be nice to put on my like a little crunch with the. Uh-huh. Or like the crunch on top of the mac and cheese. If I had to get rid of a food and say like a bye Felicia, it would definitely be fucking turkey.
Turkey. I don't mind turkey as long as it's turkey breast. And also I also don't like green bean casserole.
Oh, I used to, but I realized it was just the fried onions on top of it.
Oh, sure. Yep.
Yeah. Yep. That I realized now I'm older, that's the only part of it I liked. The pies are good. Like, I love a pumpkin pie. A pumpkin pie cheesecake is fantastic. I'm not a big apple pie person at all. Love me a pumpkin pie, though.
One year, Chelsea did Friendsgiving, and she made these little tiny pies. They're like tiny pumpkin pies, and they were delicious.
Cute. I love that. One year I made a pumpkin pie cheesecake and the crust of it wasn't a regular crust. The crust of it was salted caramel apple cookies. That was the crust.
That sounds really good.
Bro, it was so fucking tasty. I might do that. I think I'm like chilling alone for Thanksgiving. Last year I had Thanksgiving with Nicole, but I don't know. I feel like I don't know what I'm going to do. Anyway, yeah, I'm just going to probably make pulled pork sandwiches for Thanksgiving and just do me.
Nice. Yeah. One year I made myself French fried eggplant and pizza, homemade pizza for Thanksgiving because we weren't doing anything. And then I watched the dog show on TV.
I love it. I love it. It just come up. No one says you have to eat boring beige food.
Yeah.
For Thanksgiving.
Yeah, you
like,
don't have
to. Fuck that business. If you don't like it, don't eat it. Although I will say, cornbread stuffing is really good. Yeah. But it's all mushy. Like, Thanksgiving food is the type of food you eat when you can't eat solids.
Yes, it's old people.
Why is it
food.
All mushy?
Yep.
It's all geriatric food.
Mm-hmm.
For people with no flavor palate. And that
or
is
teeth.
Or teeth. Maybe that's why old people get so amped about Thanksgiving.
If you're gonna get your wisdom teeth out, do it in November.
Yeah, do it for Thanksgiving. That way you can just mash stuff with the tongue in the roof of your mouth. You won't even have to chew. Oh, I love it. I love it. All right, should we do housekeeping real quick before we get into this long spiel that I got?
For sure. Don't forget to like, rate, and subscribe our podcast on Apple Podcasts because it helps us get seen and it helps other people find us. Also, don't forget to subscribe to us on whatever platform you listen to us on so that you'll never miss an episode. We also want to hear from you on our social media. We have Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. We also want to hear your stories of weird, true things that have happened to you. So please email us those at contact@perfectstranglers.com. We haven't gotten one of those in a while.
We haven't.
Yeah. So also while you're at it, check out our website, which is perfectstranglers.com. It'd be cool to, you know, I think we have a few more listeners now. So, yeah. New listeners, please share your weird stories. And then what we like to do here on Perfect Stranglers is we like to share your weird, cool, true stories on the podcast. So anything that's happened to you, if you have seen a ghost, if you have been abducted by aliens, if you saw Bigfoot, if there was a weird coincidence and it freaked you the hell out, like other dimension stuff or like glitches in the matrix, let us know.
Bro, can we? I keep on saying bro and I don't know what that's all about. No one has said that to me at all in the last like months. I don't know why I keep saying that. What the fuck's wrong with me? Okay, glitches in the matrix. We need to do that as an episode. Because I don't understand it. I was thinking of this. I was like, I want to do things that I don't understand. The Masons, the Illuminati, glitches in the matrix. Those.
Yeah. So hopefully some of our new listeners have a story like that.
Yeah. I'm taking a pic for the gram real quick. That looks genuine. That looks like genuine happiness.
Not. Let's talk about murder.
You know what? That's what I need. That's what I need tonight is I need to watch Metalocalypse. I don't know. You just reminded me of Metalocalypse.
Hell yeah. There, we got a real smile. Look at me smiling. My nickname when I was a baby was Smiley Kylie, and then my brother changed it to Cryly, and it's been that ever since.
Cryly?
Yeah. I don't have trauma. I don't have trauma.
Sad.
Yeah. Anyway, should we get to this awful story?
Yeah. So what are we talking about today? What's the story?
Okay, so it has come to my attention that there is a couple different box killers. There is the toy box killers and the toolbox killers. And people often get those mixed up, myself included. One of my friends, she said that she watched a thing on the toolbox killers. And I was like, oh yeah, the toy box killers. And she's like, no, toolbox. And I was like, yeah, I know it's toolbox, but it keeps autocorrecting to toy box because I've said toy box so much that my phone learned it. And I was like, I need to, we're going to just do all of the boxes, dick in the box. So we're going to be doing the toolbox killers today.
Toolbox killers, yes. The toy box killer is that old guy with the mustache. I don't know his name, but we are talking about the tool.
Yes.
Box.
So the
killers.
The toy box killer was David Parker Ray. Okay.
Yeah.
That is not very similar crimes. Regarding, you know, killing. But different box. Different box.
Different
and
box.
And there's two of them in this case instead of one.
Okay. Oh.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah, there's two, which is why this is so long, because I have to, like, go into both of them, and it's just like, let's get into it.
Okay.
Okay, so Tim the Toolman Taylor, Toolbox Killers. Not associated with Tim, but, you know. So let's get into the childhoods real quick. First name is Lawrence Sigmund Bittaker. So Bittaker was born in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, September 27th of 1940. He was an unwanted child of a couple who did not want to have kids.
Oh, that's so sad.
Yeah, this is a sad one. I'm sorry. This is a downer. This entire thing, there's no sunshine in this case.
Okay.
Even their names suck, so... It is what it is. He was placed in an orphanage by his mom and was adopted by Mr. and Mrs. George Bittaker as an infant. His adopted father worked in the aviation industry, probably made sunglasses. Get it? Aviator sunglasses.
Oh, okay.
I'm so stupid. Which required the family to frequently move around the United States throughout his childhood, so he never really stayed in one spot for too long. Bittaker was first arrested for shoplifting at the age of 12, and he had a minor criminal record over the next 4 years after further arrests for the same offense, robbery, or shoplifting, whatever, in addition to petty theft, which definitely put a light on him. The authorities kind of knew who he was as a kid. He was a troublemaker. He would later claim that these numerous theft-related offenses committed throughout his childhood had been attempts to compensate for the lack of love he received from his parents. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I get it.
Yeah.
Although he was very smart. He had reportedly an IQ of 138, so he was very intelligent. He was very articulate. He considered school to be very tedious and just like a shitty experience. He dropped out of high school in 1957. By this stage in his childhood, he and his adoptive parents were living in California. Within a year of dropping out of high school, he had been arrested for car theft, a hit and run, and evading arrest. And for these offenses, he went to prison at the California Youth Authority, where he remained there until he was 18, so about a year. After his release, Bittaker discovered that his adoptive parents had disowned him because of all of that, and they moved to another state, and he apparently never saw his parents after that.
Mm.
Next, we're going to get into Roy Norris. So Roy Lewis Norris was born in Greeley, Colorado on February 5th of 1948. Norris was conceived prior to his parents being married, which was shame, shame on your name. His parents had married to avoid the social stigma surrounding an illegitimate birth at the time. So he was also like born under kind of unwanted circumstances or accidental circumstances. Norris's extended family lived within a short distance of his parents' home due to his grandpa's real estate investments. His father worked in a scrapyard. His mom was a drug-addicted housewife. And he occasionally lived with his parents throughout his childhood, but he really pretty much stayed with his grandparents, and then eventually he was placed in foster care throughout the state of Colorado.
Mm.
So, you know, two bad childhoods here, okay? According to Norris, his childhood recollections were kind of interspersed with memories of wrongful accusations while living with his biological parents and of being neglected by many of the foster families he lived with. He was apparently frequently denied sufficient food or clothing. He also claimed to have been sexually abused when he was in the care of a Hispanic family, later stating that the prejudice that he held towards Hispanic people originated from the neglect and abuse that he had when he was placed in a care of that Hispanic family growing up in foster care. So while he was living with his birth parents at the age of 16, so it sounds like he was with his birth parents, with his grandparents, was in the foster care system, then went back to his birth parents, like just really tossed around. Norris visited the home of a female relative who was in her early 20s and began speaking to her in a sexual way. She ordered him to leave the house and let Norris's father know, and Norris's father threatened him with beating him. Norris subsequently stole his dad's car and drove into the Rocky Mountains, where he attempted to commit suicide by injecting pure air into an artery of his arm.
Okay. That is painful, though.
That's painful. And it's so when I was pregnant and they had to put an IV in me, I was so paranoid that I was going to get an air bubble. I kept on asking them. I was like, this isn't going to happen. And they kept on flicking it because they flick it. And I was like, why are you fucking flicking it? I literally thought I was going to die because I had an IV in my arm.
Yeah.
It terrifies me for some reason.
Because if you have an air bubble. Not
for
some
reason, for a reason.
Yeah. If it goes to your heart, then you die.
Exactly.
Or whatever.
Yeah. But that didn't work. He was later apprehended as a runaway. I feel like if it didn't work for him, it's probably not going to do something in a hospital.
Right. Like it's kind of hard to do.
Yeah. But like weirder things have happened.
Yeah.
You know. But he was later apprehended as a runaway and returned to live with his parents. When he returned home, Norris's parents had a little sit-down chat with him saying that he and his younger sister were unwanted children and they wanted to get a divorce when they both were 18.
Okay, wow. That's...
Yeah. Yeah.
It's always what you want to hear.
It is. It is. Wow. It is the best case scenario for a youth in trouble.
You're right. Unwanted.
Yep.
Wow. Nothing. That's terrible.
What could happen? A year later, Norris dropped out of school and joined the Navy. So, you know, typical path here. He was stationed in San Diego in 1965 and was deployed to serve in the Vietnam War in 69. Although he did not see active combat during his four-month tour of duty, he was honorably discharged from the Navy after his one tour. So within days of parole, now we're going to get back to Bittaker, within days of parole from the California Youth Authority, from when he was like arrested or whatever, he was arrested again for transporting a stolen vehicle across state lines. In August of 59, he was sentenced to 18 months in prison to be served at the Oklahoma State Reformatory. And then he was later transferred to a medical center for federal prisons to serve the remainder of his sentence. And then in 1960, Bittaker was released from prison, went right back into the crimes. Within months of release, he was arrested in L.A. for robbery, because this guy just loves to steal shit. He mm-hmm. just wants to take things. And so that was in May of 61. He was sentenced to 15 years in prison for the robbery. While incarcerated for this robbery, he was diagnosed by a psychiatrist as being, quote, highly manipulative. The psychiatrist described Bittaker as having considerable concealed hostility.
Okay.
I just love these old-timey, what are they called? Diagnostics is what you do on a car, but that's what we're going to call them. Diagnoses?
Yeah.
Okay. Huh. I just love them. Having considerable concealed hostility.
Yeah. So instead of saying, like, he bottled up his anger...
Yeah.
That's basically what they're trying to say, but they said it he was in a very Shakespearean, poetic way.
Yeah, this bitch is a powder keg about to blow. No, he has considerable concealed hostility.
Yes.
Yeah. So he was released from parole. He was released on parole in 63 after completing two of his 15-year sentence. In October of 64, he again was imprisoned for a parole violation. And then 2 years later in 66, he underwent further examinations by two independent psychiatrists. Both of them classified him as a borderline psychopath, a highly manipulative individual unable to acknowledge the consequences of his own actions. So he's a man.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Bittaker explained. That's it. Bittaker explained. That's the end of my case. Thank you. He was a man. Bittaker explained to one of them that his criminal activities gave him a feeling of self-importance, although he insisted that circumstantial matters pertaining to his environment and upbringing decreased his ability to, like, resist the crime. So he's basically saying, I'm a product of my childhood, and now I'm going to be bad, and that's my excuse.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, he was prescribed an antipsychotic med, and he was again released into society to be a menace. A month after his parole, in July of 67, he was again arrested and convicted of theft and leaving the scene of an accident. He was sentenced to 5 years, but was released in April of 1970, so like 3 years later. In March of 71, he was again arrested for burglary, and he... continued to repeated parole violations. He kept on having parole violations. He was then sentenced to serve between 6 months and 15 years in prison in October of 71. Again, 3 years later, he was released. So it's like he's in prison for 15 years, released after three. In prison for 15 years, released after three. And if he would have just stayed in prison for those 15 years, maybe he would have killed someone and then been in there for life. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
Yeah. So in 74, he was arrested for assault with an attempt to commit murder after he stabbed a young supermarket employee who accused him of stealing, which is, yes, he did. The employee had observed Bittaker stealing a steak and had followed Bittaker outside into the store's parking lot, where he asked him whether he had forgotten to pay or not. Bittaker responded by stabbing the employee in the chest, just like narrowly missing his heart.
Oh my God.
Bittaker attempted to flee the scene, but was quickly restrained by two other employees. The employee, his name was Gary Louis, survived the stabbing, and Bittaker was convicted of the lesser charge of assault with a deadly weapon and sent to California Men's Colony in San Luis Obispo. Yeah, California. In case you didn't know by the California Men's Colony name, that's in California. Yep. So then we're going to get over to Norris after he was back from his tour of duty. In November of 69, Norris was arrested for his first known sexual offense. He was charged with both rape and assault in an attempt to commit rape. 3 months later, in February of 1970, Norris attempted to deceive a woman walking he attempted to deceive a woman into allowing him into her home. So she was home alone. He was like trying to like get himself to like go in, convince her like, hey, I'm safe, let me come into your house. So when the woman refused, he attempted to break into her house, and the woman called the police, who arrested Norris before he had the opportunity to harm this woman. Less than 3 months after this offense, Norris was diagnosed by military psychologists with a severe schizoid personality. He was given an administrative discharge from the Navy under terms labeled psychological problems. So in May of 1970, Norris, on bail for his latest offense, attacked a female student whom had been stalking. He had been stalking on the grounds of San Diego State University campus. Norris repeatedly struck her on the back of the head with a rock until she slumped to her knees before he repeatedly beat her head against the sidewalk as he was, like, kneeling on her lower back. So she was on her face down. He put his knee on her lower back, grabbed her hair, and just slammed her head.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, this is a graphic case, by the way.
Holy shit.
I should let y'all know. This is a really graphic case. Shortly after that, but you're listening to true crime, so, like, expect it. Shortly after that, Norris was charged with assault with a deadly weapon. He was committed to 5 years in prison at, God, I can't pronounce this, Atascandero State Hospital? Atascandero. I'm sorry if that's incorrect. It probably is. Where he was classified as a mentally disordered sex offender. So naturally, we're going to release him back into the wild, as we do. So he was released from that hospital in 1975 with 5 years probation, having been declared by doctors as an individual who was, quote, of no further danger to others, just 3 months after his release. Because you're healed, man. So Norris then approached a 27-year-old woman after his release. She was walking home from a restaurant in Redondo Beach and offered her a ride on his motorcycle. When she politely declined, Norris parked his motorcycle and grabbed the woman's scarf. He twisted it around her neck before informing her that he intended to rape her and dragged her into the nearby bushes. She was fearing for her life, and so the woman did not resist. She would rather be raped than killed. Mm-hmm. Although the rape was reported to police, they were initially unable to find the person responsible. But 1 month later, the victim found Norris's motorcycle and noted the license plate number. So she recognized the motorcycle, said, I'm going to snag this number. She immediately gave that number to the police, and Norris was then able to be arrested for the rape. A year later, he was tried and convicted for this offense and sent to the California Men's Colony in San Luis Obispo. While incarcerated there, he befriended Bittaker. Mm. And that's where this story really takes off. So, they met at the California Men's Colony, where they bonded over having a common interest in sexual violence, specifically the violence of women. Bittaker and Norris initially were, like, loosely acquainted in 1977, a year after Norris arrived in the prison. Bittaker's initial impression, so remember, Bittaker is the brains of all of this. He's the smart one who likes to steal shit. Norris is kind of the dummy who likes to get his jollies off of hurting women.
Okay.
So Bittaker's initial impression of Norris upon his arrival was that he was a very clever guy, but he was... So Bittaker thought that Norris was, like, clever, but I feel like there's a difference between street smart and, like, intelligent.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, Bittaker was an intelligent, very well-spoken, and I think Norris was more of, like, that street smart dude.
Mm-hmm.
So Bittaker said that Norris was a clever man who was also largely associated with, like, more hardened criminals, like motorcycle gangs, in addition to dealing contraband drugs in the prison. According to Norris, Bittaker saved him from being attacked by fellow inmates on at least two occasions, and by 1978, the pair had become close friends in the prison, discovering that they shared an interest in the sexual violence. They thought misogyny was the bee's knees. Norris also divulged to Bittaker that the biggest stimulation for him was seeing frightened young women, adding that this was the primary reason he had a lengthy record for sexual offenses. So Bittaker, who is not known to have committed any sexual offenses prior to meeting Norris, he also divulged to Norris that if he ever raped a woman, he would kill her so he wouldn't leave a witness behind to his crime.
Don't like that.
Don't like that. No, don't like it. So when alone, the pair regularly discussed plans to travel around, assault and murder teenage girls after they were released. This was like a fever dream that they had. It's like, yeah, when we get out, we're going to run it and stuff. Like, oh, we're going to run a business. Let's like do this, do that. No, they're like, yeah, let's fucking run. Like, that's what we want to do. We want to fuck girls and we want to like rape and murder them and like have a van. That was their fever dream. Could you imagine? Wow. I just wonder if how many inmates overheard this conversation and could have said something. But then I'm sure they hear so much shit in prison and they're like, yeah, right. That's just them talking.
Right. They get desensitized to it.
Exactly.
And also, you don't want to be a snitch.
Yeah, you don't want to be a snitch. And you never know how long they're going to be in there. I mean, how many times was Bittaker in for 15 years and he got out after 3, you know?
Oh, that's true, too. Yeah.
You just never know. When alone, the pair regularly discussed plans to assault and murder teenage girls after they were released. This shared fantasy evolved into a very elaborate plan to murder one girl of each teenage year, 13 through 19. So a 13-year-old, 14-year-old, 15-year-old. The pair vowed to become reacquainted once they were released to follow through with their plan.
Wow.
I told y'all this was fucked up. It's fucked up.
You know, and then just with two messed up minds together, just like feeding off each other's ideas and stuff, one-upping each other, mm-hmm. like.
Yep. It's not good. It ain't good. So, sorry, that's my neighbor's dog. Do you hear it?
Yeah. Is that like a medium-sized dog?
Yeah. How'd you know?
I love dogs. I just love dogs.
Okay. So let's talk about their release from the men's colony. Bittaker was released from the men's colony in October 15th of 1978. So he spent about 8 years there, 7, 8 years, something like that there. He returned to Los Angeles and found work as a mechanist. He was very skilled, apparently, very reputable. He was nice. He helped out in the community. He gave people, like, helped out at, like, homeless shelters and, like, gave food to the homeless and stuff like that.
Nice.
Yeah.
That was nice.
Maybe he would have stayed on the straight and narrow if he never would have met up with Norris again. You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah.
So he went from stealing to giving.
Yeah, you gotta wonder. Yeah.
Yeah. But unfortunately, that's not how this works out. 3 months after Bittaker was released from the men's colony, on January 15th, 1979, Norris was released from prison, moved into his mom's home in Redondo Beach. Within 1 month of Norris's release, he raped a woman, and then he just abandoned her in a desert. He soon found employment as an electrician in Compton. So he imagine this man going in and out of your house as an electrician.
No.
Hard pass.
Yeah.
Do you also get really nervous if you, like, you're a woman home alone and like the cable guy has to come or someone like a plumber has to come or anything? Do you get nervous?
Yeah, I do because ordinarily, like, I have my dogs and they would definitely bite somebody if they were like attacking me or something, but I have to put the dogs away when there's service people here.
Yep.
So,
yeah. I get really nervous too. That's something that I don't think women talk about enough. And that's why I wish there was more, like, an all-female mechanic shop, I feel like is so needed. All-female electricians.
Yeah.
That's a whole nother day, but that's just a sidebar. He was working as an electrician in Compton. It's a good idea.
Yeah, like, you should make an app or something. like Angie's List for ladies.
For ladies? Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, for real. Like, I am lucky that I work in, I live where I live and I don't have to deal with like random men coming to my house and like doing that stuff.
Yeah.
But if I ever live in a place where I have to do that, like, yeah.
Yeah.
Trademark, copyright. Don't steal that, please. You heard it here first. But shortly after Norris got out, he raped a woman and then he became an electrician. He received a letter from Bittaker. And then in late February of 79, the pair met at a hotel and rekindled their relationship and their plan to rape, pillage, and plunder young girls. Yep. So in order for the pair to abduct these teenage girls, Bittaker decided that they would need a van as opposed to a car. Together, they purchased a silverish-gray 1977 GMC Vendura in February of 79. Picture your standard creep van.
Yeah,
okay. According to Bittaker, yeah, this is your standard creep van.
Okay.
According to Bittaker, when viewing the sliding door, he realized he or Norris could, quote, pull up to a teenage girl real close and not have to open the doors all the way. And they nicknamed this van Murder Mac.
Okay. So, you know. Wow. They had a plan. They had a name for the car.
Yeah.
The vehicle.
Very well thought out. Very yeah. well thought out.
Yeah.
So this van, just set this, like, the scene for you. It had a cooler in the back with pop and beer.
Okay.
The cooler in the back was underneath the bed. There was a bed back there. Also underneath the bed, there was various tools. There was a toolbox so that they could, the toolbox killers, you guys, there was a toolbox so that they could do all the things that they wanted to do to these girls using these tools.
You know what? They could have done so much cooler stuff with that van. They could have went to Grateful Dead shows and just like camped out in the van or whatever. Right. When was this? Was this in the
79?
Yeah. Yeah. They should have did that instead. But not yeah. killed anyone.
They should have smoked a bowl and went and had like chill time.
Yeah, and like went and just followed the dead and not made people dead, you know? They could have had a grilled cheese food dead. Truck.
Follow the dead, would you say?
Grilled cheese.
What kind of cheese?
Grilled cheese food truck.
Have we talked about this before? How like A Rice Krispie or a grilled cheese food truck would be great. Could you imagine how low the cost of a Rice Krispie food truck would be and you just make gourmet Rice Krispie treats?
Yeah. Like, do you want it dipped in peanut butter? Do you want it dipped in chocolate? Do you want sprinkles?
Do you not want sprinkles?
Caramel.
Imagine a cookies and cream one. So it's like the cookies and cream Rice Krispie treats, and then you dip it in like a cookies and cream like icing flavor, and then you put Oreos on it.
Oh my God.
That sound good.
Yeah.
These are the things that go through my mind on a daily basis. When I say I talk to myself around my house, this is exactly what I say to myself. Wow. All the time.
You're going to have to come up with ideas for recipes.
Did I ever tell you that I wanted to go in our cookbook. It does. Did I ever tell you that I wanted to have a restaurant, like a bakery and a hair place? I wanted to do hair and I wanted to have a bakery that had like cupcakes and stuff. And I wanted to call it Kylie's Pretty Hungry.
Cute. That's cute.
Thank you. Thank you. Anyway, let's get back to the murder.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay. This dog is like doing something up there. I wonder if the old man above me has a lady over.
Oh, maybe.
I think he's calming down. Oh, I'm not going to wait for him. If you guys hear barking in the background, that's just my neighbor upstairs. He's old but he's sweet, but his dog seems a little vicious at whatever's happening. I digress. Let's get to the murders. From February to June of 1979, Bittaker and Norris picked up over 20 female hitchhikers. The pair did not assault these girls in any manner. They basically were practicing. These were like practice runs, just a way for them to develop different ruses and like different ways to lure girls into the van voluntarily. and of discovering secluded locations. So they're like, wonder if I tell her this, will this work? Okay, we picked her up. Let's let her go. Take her to the secured location. Let her go. See how that works. Like, just practicing to pick up girls.
Wow.
Yep. In late April of 79, the pair found an isolated fire road in the San Gabriel Mountains. Bittaker broke open the locked gate with a crowbar and replaced the lock with one that he owned. So when people would go by and see that it was locked, like people in like the parks or whatever, they'd be like, oh, we're all good. But no, we weren't all good.
Hmm. Wow.
So the first...
I never would have thought of that.
It's smart, right?
It is. It was smart.
I know. I hate that it's smart. So let's get to the first girl, Lucinda Lynn Schaefer. So Bittaker and Norris killed their first victim, a 16-year-old Lucinda Lynn Schaefer, on June 24th of 79. Schaefer was last seen leaving a Presbyterian church meeting in Redondo Beach. In his written accounts of the events of the day, of this day, Bittaker stated that he and Norris first finished constructing the bed the pair had installed in the back of the van. Beneath was where they had the tools. They had additional clothing as well, along with the cooler. At approximately 11 a.m., the pair drove to the beach area drinking beer, smoking grass, and flirting with girls. We had no set routine. At about 7:46 p.m., so 11, 12, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, about 8 hours later, Norris spotted Schaefer walking down a side street and said to Bittaker, that's a cute little blonde. So after unsuccessfully attempting to entice Schaefer into their van with, they offered her weed, they offered her a lift home, Bittaker and Norris drove further ahead and parked alongside a driveway. Norris got out of the van, opened the passenger side door, leaned into the van with his head and shoulders obscured from like view behind the door. So he was standing outside of it with his head in it so that the girl wouldn't recognize her. When Schaefer passed the van, Norris exchanged a few words with her before dragging her into the van and closing the door. So this is something that they would do in subsequent murders because they found that it worked. Bittaker turned the radio to full volume as they drove away, or as Norris bound the victim's arms and legs and gagged her with duct tape. As Bittaker drove Schaefer to the fire road in San Gabriel Mountains, where in April the pair had previously switched those locks. So despite initially screaming when she was abducted, no one could hear her because of the loud music and stuff. Schaefer apparently quickly regained her composure. In his written account of that night, Bittaker wrote that Schaefer displayed a magnificent state of self-control and composed acceptance of the conditions of which she had no control. She shed no tears, offered no resistance, and expressed no great concern for her safety. I guess she knew what was coming. At the fire road, Norris first raped Schaefer after instructing Bittaker to go take a walk and return in 1 hour. Upon returning to the van, Bittaker raped the girl in Norris's absence, so they switched off. Upon the second occasion, she was raped by Norris in Bittaker's absence. Schaefer asked him whether or not they intended to kill her, and Norris replied no. In response, Schaefer requested to be allowed time to pray before she was killed if that was their true intention. So they were like trading off, and she asked if she could pray before she got killed.
That's so sad.
You know, in their subsequent accounts of this actual murder, Bittaker and Norris gave like differing accounts as to who argued over whether they should kill her or release her. Each stated that they argued that they should kill her. But it didn't really matter. Schaefer pleaded for only a second to pray before Norris attempted to manually strangle her. After about 45 seconds, he became disturbed at the look in her eyes, apparently, and ran to the front of the van and vomited. Bittaker then manually strangled Schaefer until she collapsed to the ground. He twisted a wire coat hanger around her neck with a vice grip until Schaefer's convulsions ceased. Schaefer was denied her request to pay before Bittaker and Norris killed her.
Ugh.
Her body was wrapped in a plastic shower curtain and thrown over a canyon that Bittaker selected. According to Norris, after Bittaker threw Schaefer over the canyon, he assured Norris that the animals would eat her up so there would be no evidence left.
Mm-hmm.
I know. Second one is Andrea Joy Hall. So on July of 1979, 2 weeks after the murder of Schaefer, Bittaker and Norris encountered an 18-year-old Andrea Hall hitchhiking along the Pacific Coast Highway. As the pair slowed down the van to a halt to offer Hall a lift, another vehicle pulled over and offered Hall exactly that, which she accepted. So Bittaker and Norris followed the vehicle from a distance until Hall exited the vehicle in Redondo Beach. So on this occasion, Norris hid in the back of the van in order to get Hall into believing Bittaker was traveling alone. Inside the van, Bittaker offered Hall a drink from the cooler from the back of the van, and Norris, who was hidden behind a bedspread in the rear of the van where the bed was, jumped on Hall when she attempted to get the drink out of the cooler, and after a very, like, she put up a fight, he managed to subdue her by twisting her arm behind her back, causing her to scream in pain. Norris then gagged Hall with tape and bound her wrists and ankles like he did with Schaefer. So Bittaker and Hall drove Norris to the location in the mountains beyond where they had earlier taken Schaefer. At this location, she was raped twice by Bittaker and once by Norris. While Bittaker was raping Hall for the second time, Norris saw what he believed to be vehicle headlights approaching. Bittaker clasped his hands over Hall's mouth and dragged her into the nearby bushes as Norris drove to try and find the vehicle, but he never found a vehicle that he thought he saw. When Norris returned, them as a group drove to a further location in the San Gabriel Mountains. Bittaker forced Hall to walk uphill naked alongside the road and then to perform oral sex on him before ordering Hall to pose for several Polaroid pictures naked.
Gross.
Bittaker and Norris drove Hall to a third location where Bittaker again walked Hall up a nearby hill, this time as Norris drove to a nearby store to purchase alcohol. When Norris returned, Bittaker was alone and in possession of two further Polaroid pictures he had taken, both of which depicted Hall's face in expressions Norris later described of being sheer terror as she was begging for her life to be spared. So if you remember, Bittaker or Norris liked to see the shock of women,
mm-hmm.
but Bittaker was the one who took these pictures of women being in shock. So I wonder if he did that because he knew Norris would like it and yeah. like approve of it. So, yeah, she was in sheer terror and she was begging for her life to be spared in these pictures. Bittaker informed Norris that he had told Hall that he was going to kill her, and he challenged her to give him as many reasons as she could come up with as to why she should be allowed to live. At this point, as she was begging to be allowed to live, he thrust an ice pick through her ear into her brain.
Oh my God.
He then turned her body over and thrust the ice pick into the other ear, stomping on it until the handle broke.
Oh.
Bittaker then strangled Hall before throwing her body off a cliff. Later on, when her body was found, her body wasn't found. Her skull, her bones were found. The ice pick was still lodged in the skull when they found it.
Oh my God. Holy shit.
So this is going to be number 3 and 4, Jackie Doris Gilliam and Jacqueline Leah Lamp. On September 3rd, Bittaker and Norris found two girls, Jackie and Jacqueline. So Jackie Doris Gilliam and Jacqueline Leah Lamp, so Gilliam and Lamp, sitting on a bus bench near Hermosa Beach. Lamp and Gilliam had been hitchhiking along the Pacific Coast Highway. Stop hitchhiking, girls. Before Bittaker and Norris observed them as they were just like resting at a bus stop. Bittaker and Norris offered the girls a ride and they accepted. Inside the van, both girls were offered weed by Norris and they accepted. Shortly after entering the van, both girls realized that Bittaker had steered the van off of the Pacific Coast Highway and was driving in the direction of the San Gabriel Mountains. When the girls protested this, both Bittaker and Norris attempted to calm down the girls' concerns with excuses or whatever. With the girls weren't buying it. They tried to we're just going here, we're going there, this is what we're doing. And the girls were like, no.
Yeah.
So Lamp... I'm so sorry about this. Lamp was only 13. She attempted to open the sliding door where Norris hit her on the back of the head with a bag filled with lead weights, briefly knocking her unconscious. He then overpowered 15-year-old Gilliam. As he began to bind and gag Gilliam, Lamp regained consciousness and again attempted to flee the van. Norris ended up twisting her arm behind her back and dragged her back into the van. As the struggle, ensued, Bittaker, noting that the girl's struggle was, in full view of potential witnesses, he stopped the van and punched Gilliam in the face and assisted Norris in finishing binding and gagging the two girls. So Gilliam and Lamp were then driven to, again, the San Gabriel Mountains. They were held captive for almost 2 days by being bound and gagged and repeating instances of sexual and physical abuse. Both men slept in the van alongside the two hostages, with each alternate, they were lookouts. So both girls were sleeping and then the guys would take turns on the lookout. On one occasion, Bittaker walked Lamp onto a nearby hill, forced her to pose for pornographic pictures before returning her into the van. Bittaker also asked Norris to take several Polaroid pictures of himself and Gilliam, both nude and clothed. In the first of three instances in which Bittaker raped Gilliam, he also created a tape recording of himself raping her, forcing the girl to pretend she was his cousin and informing Gilliam to feel free to express her pain.
Ew.
Bittaker also apparently tortured Gilliam by stabbing her breasts with an ice pick and using a vice grip pliers to tear off part of one nipple.
Oh my god.
After about 2 days in captivity, Lamp and Gilliam were murdered. At Bittaker's subsequent trial, Norris claimed that he suggested that Gilliam be killed as quickly as possible, and unlike Lamp, she had been largely cooperative throughout the period of her captivity, where Bittaker said, no, they only die once anyway, so Gilliam was struck in each ear with an ice pick and then strangled to death.
Ugh.
Maybe it was her skull that was found. One of the girls with the ice pick was found with her skull and the ice pick still in. So after Bittaker had murdered Gilliam, he then forced Lamp out of the van. Upon exiting the sliding door, Bittaker said, you wanted to stay a virgin, now you can die a virgin, before Norris struck her in the head with a sledgehammer. Bittaker then strangled Lamp until he believed she had died. When Lamp opened her eyes, Norris again bludgeoned her repeatedly, and then Bittaker strangled her eventually to death.
Ugh.
The bodies of Gilliam and Lamp were thrown over an embankment. So now we have Shirley Lynette Ledford. So Bittaker, and this is their final victim. She was 16-year-old. Shirley Lynette Ledford abducted her on October 31st, so Halloween of 1979. Ledford was abducted as she stood outside a gas station hitchhiking home from a Halloween party in Sunland, Tujunga suburb of Los Angeles. People can't pronounce Wisconsin names. I can't pronounce California names.
Yeah.
I can say Oconomowoc till my face turns blue. I can't say Tujunga. It just doesn't feel natural. I don't know, so I'm self-conscious about saying it.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks for understanding. Oregon, Michigan.
Yeah.
So investigators believe that Ledford accepted a ride home from Bittaker and Norris because she recognized Bittaker because he's known to have frequented the restaurant where Ledford had a part-time job as a waitress. So she may have felt a little bit safe by recognizing his face.
Yeah.
After she accepted the offer for a lift home and entering the van, Ledford was offered weed by Norris. She refused. Bittaker drove the van to a secluded street where Norris drew a knife, bound and gagged Ledford with tape. Bittaker then traded places with Norris, who drove very, very aimlessly, randomly, just around the city for about an hour as Bittaker remained with Ledford in the back of the van. After removing the tape from the girl's mouth and legs, Bittaker tormented Ledford. He was slapping her and mocking her, then beat her with his fists as he repeatedly shouted for her to say, say something. Then as Ledford began screaming and shouting, he was then scream louder. And Ledford would continue to scream, and Bittaker kept on asking her as he struck her, what's the matter? Don't you like to scream? So he would ask her to scream and then taunt her for screaming and saying scream louder and then slap her and ask why she's screaming.
That's weird.
I know, it's really weird. So as Ledford began to cry, she pleaded with Bittaker, repeatedly saying, no, don't touch me. They did decide to, so this whole torture of Ledford was tape recorded.
Oh.
So from the point of her getting into, sorry for this, a very important part that I forgot. So her getting into this van and whatever, they started tape recording. So like they heard her yelling, "What's the matter? Do you like to scream?" And like, I think that's why she was so vocal, because she, they wanted her to be so vocal so that they had something to go back to and like get off on it. So she could be heard saying like, "Oh no, no, don't touch me," all of this stuff, as the sounds of Bittaker could be heard extracting either the sledgehammer or the pliers. You could hear the metal coming out of the toolbox. That can be heard on the tape recorder that he switched on after entering the back of the van. Norris later described hearing screams, just constant screams, emanating from the rear of the van as he drove. So shortly after Norris switched places with Bittaker, he himself switched the tape recorder that Bittaker had used to record much of the time that had been in the back of the van with Ledford. Norris first shouted to Ledford, "Go ahead and scream or I'll make you scream." She said, "I'll scream if you stop hitting me." Then there was a lot of high-pitched screams, and Norris encouraged her to continue until he told her to stop. Norris reached for the sledgehammer, and she said, "Oh no, stop doing that," because she saw what was going to happen. Norris then struck Ledford once on the left elbow. In response, she informed Norris that her elbow was broken. She pleaded to not get hit again. Norris again raised a sledgehammer and did hit her 25 consecutive times on the same elbow with the sledgehammer before asking, what are you sniveling about? As Ledford continued to scream and cry. So
that's intense.
Yeah. So Roy Norris described his recollections of the audio tape the pair had created of Shirley Ledford's rape and torture. That comes into play in the trial, which we'll get to. After approximately 2 hours of captivity, Norris killed Ledford by strangling her with a wire coat hanger, which he tightened with pliers. Ledford did not react much to the act of strangulation, although she did die with her eyes open. Bittaker then opted to discard her body on just a random law in order to view the reaction from the press. So this is when that was a mistake.
Yeah.
Basically. So the pair drove by the randomly selected house in Sunland where Norris discovered of Ledford's body in a bed of ivy on the front lawn. Her body was found by a jogger the following morning, and an autopsy revealed that in addition to having been sexually violated, she died of strangulation after receiving extensive blunt force trauma to her face, head, breasts, and left elbow. So Bittaker later claimed that the tape recording the pair had created of Ledford's abuse and torture offered nothing other than the evidence of a threesome, adding that towards the very end, Ledford was screaming for him and Norris to kill her.
What?
So Ledford was just basically like, she was in so much pain of the torture that she just wanted to die. So she's like, "Kill me, kill me."
That's terrible.
And the only, like, jollies that Bittaker claims that they got off of it was, "Now we have proof that we had a threesome."
Gross.
You know. So, now that a body has been found, in November of 79, Norris became reacquainted with a friend named Joseph Jackson, who he was in prison with. Norris told Jackson about everything that him and Bittaker had been doing over the past 5 months in very graphic detail. He said he let Jackson know in graphic detail about the murder of Shirley Ledford, the only victim whose body was found at the time. He also told Jackson that in addition to the 5 murders him and Bittaker committed, there had been 3 additional instances where he and Bittaker abducted or attempted to abduct women, but they had either escaped or were raped but released. So after hearing this, Jackson consulted his attorney, who advised him to inform the authorities. Jackson's like, "Fuck yeah, we need to do this." So him and his attorney went together to the Los Angeles Police Department, and that police department relayed the information to the Hermosa Beach Police, which must have been the jurisdiction where the body was found.
Mm-hmm.
A Hermosa Beach detective named Paul Bynum was assigned to investigate Jackson's claims of what Norris confessed, the murders and everything else, the abductions, all of that, that had occurred between June and October, because there was obviously missing girls that were like being searched for as well during this time. Bynum initially noted that Jackson's statements as to Norris's confessions did match reports on file for several teenage girls who were reported missing. In addition, the incident Norris had confided to Jackson, where he claimed he and Bittaker had spayed mace in the face of a woman who had been dragged into Bittaker's van and raped by both men, matched a report filed in relation to an incident that occurred in September 30th of that year. So one day before they abducted... 30 days of September, one day before they abducted Ledford and did what we just talked about. So in this report, a young woman named Robin Robick said she had mace sprayed in her face before being dragged into a van and raped by two Caucasian men in their mid-30s before being released. Although Robick had reported the abduction and rape, they were unable to identify the assailants. So Bynum... dispatched an investigator to visit Robeck at her home in Oregon, Michigan, to show her a series of mugshots. Without hesitation, Robeck positively identified two photos presented to her as the men who raped her on September 30th. She identified Bittaker and Norris. So after Bittaker and Norris were linked to the rape of Robin Rebick, the Hermosa Beach police placed Norris under surveillance. After a few days, they caught him dealing pot. On November 20th of 79, he was arrested by Hermosa Beach police for parole violation because he was selling pot. The same day, at the Burbank Motel where he was living, Bittaker was arrested for the rape of Robin Rebick. So although Robeck had ID'd mugshots of Bittaker and Norris, she was actually unable to positively ID them in a police lineup. But police observed Norris dealing pot, and Bittaker had been in possession of drugs at the time of his arrest, so luckily they were both able to be held on charges for parole violation. A search of Bittaker's apartment revealed several Polaroid pictures, which were determined as depicting Hall and Gilliam, both who had been reported missing earlier that year. Inside Bittaker's van, investigators discovered the sledgehammer, plastic bag filled with lead weights, a book detailing how to locate police radio frequencies, a jar of Vaseline. Two necklaces later confirmed belonging to two victims, and a tape recording of a young woman in obvious distress screaming and pleading for mercy while being tortured and sexually abused. The mother of Ledford, named by Jackson as being one of the women whom Norris had confessed. Okay. The mother of Ledford identified the voice on the tape as being that of her only daughter. The voices of the two men mocking and threatening Ledford in the process of her torture and abuse were positively identified as being Roy Norris and Lawrence Bittaker. So that was like the solid proof that they needed was that tape, basically.
Mm-hmm.
Although found in Bittaker's motel were several bottles of various acidic materials, like things to get rid of a body, investigators later discovered Bittaker planned to use these acidic materials on his next victim. So inside Norris's apartment, police discovered a bracelet he took from Ledford's body as a souvenir. He also found at both the homes of Bittaker and Norris were Polaroid pictures of almost 500 teenage girls and young women, most of which was taken at Redondo Beach and Hermosa Beach, with others taken by Bittaker at a Burbank high school. Most of these pictures have been taken without the girls' knowledge or consent.
That's disgusting.
This is the most disturbing case we've ever done.
Yeah.
Hands down. Hands down. So on November 30th of 1979, Norris attended a prelim hearing in relation to his September 30th rape of Robin, who was maced. By this stage, Norris was beginning to, like, he was visibly shooken. Like, he was definitely stressed out over what was happening, and all of the authorities and everyone could see it. At the hearing, Norris waived his Miranda rights before Detective Bynum and Deputy District Attorney Stephen Kay, so the prosecutor in the case, began questioning him, initially in relation to the rape of Robin Rebick, then in relation to statements given by police by Joseph Jackson and the evidence recovered from him and Bittaker's residences on the abductions and murders. Initially, Norris completely, like, denied any involvement in any of disappearances, rapes, murders, all of that. But then he was confronted with evidence. Norris began to sing like a canary, and he did attempt, though, to portray Bittaker as being more at fault in the murders than himself. Like, he was just, like, following Bittaker's lead. So, in what Bynum and Kay later described as a, quote, casual, unconcerned manner, Norris divulged that he and Bittaker had been in the habit of driving around areas such as the Pacific Coast Highway, randomly approaching girls that they found attractive to offer them a ride, posing for photographs, asking them if they wanted weed. Most of them who they approached rejected them, which, thank God, good job, girls. Yeah. Although four girls did accept lifts from the pair, and those four girls were murdered, with a fifth victim. Their first victim was the only one that was grabbed by force.
Wow.
So inside the van, the girls, how, like, they would do it, would be overpowered, gagged, driven to the locations in the mountains, and then sexually assaulted, and then killed by strangulation. That was, like, their pattern, their routine that they did. On top of the bludgeoning of the victims in the head with a sledgehammer, so that after they would gag them, bind them, they would bludgeon them, whether with a sledgehammer or a rock, and then eventually put them out of their misery and strangle them. And then there was the two with the ice picks in their ears.
Yeah. Wow. What a nightmare.
Yeah. So the bottle, they did speak more about the bottles of acid found at Bittaker's motel. Norris knew about them and stated that they were intended for use upon their next victim, like we said, and the acts of torture and humiliation had been committed against their victims, quote, for fun. According to Norris, he said that the level of brutality that Bittaker put towards their victims just kept increasing, which with each instance, after every woman, their final victim, who actually pleaded to be killed in order to stop, was like, that's when Norris realized that Bittaker was, like, taking this to a really fucking far level.
Yeah.
So additional details by Norris. So Norris kind of, like, started confessing, but also confessing against Bittaker, and saying, I will plead, but I'm also going to give you evidence against him so that he can also be guilty. So in a press statement relating to the police investigations of the murders, this statement was released on February 7th of 1980. Los Angeles County Sheriff Peter Pitches stated that the victims have been subjected to sadistic and barbaric abuse, adding that five charges of first-degree murder would be sought against both Bittaker and Norris. Sheriff Pitches also stated that in relation to the Polaroid pictures found in Bittaker and Nora's apartments, the police had located 60 of the young women depicted, none of whom had been harmed. So they tried to find all of these girls and, like, let them know, hey, this is what was happening to you. You don't know it, but now you do. How fucked up would that be to hear?
Yeah.
One of the Polaroid pictures seized from Bittaker and Norris depicted an unidentified young white woman along with Bittaker and Norris in circumstances very similar to pictures found depicting Hall, Lamp, and Gilliam. The young woman in the pictures has never been identified. The photograph is, it basically is like there might be one further victim who neither Bittaker or Norris ever mentioned, because none of the other girls were pictured next to him except for this one unknown girl. Which is a little odd.
Yeah.
So Bittaker and Norris discarded four of the bodies in the San Gabriel Mountains, which led investigators to the bodies of two of the four victims that he and Bittaker murdered at the location. Norris actually agreed to return to the San Gabriel Mountains in search of the bodies of the girls. And in each instance, Norris brought detectives to an area where he and Bittaker had disposed of the victims' bodies. But despite extensive searches of the areas where he stated that there were bodies of Schaefer and Hall had been discarded, those bodies were never found. One interesting thing is I think Nicole watched this, and I didn't like the documentary. But there was a documentary on the Toolbox murders, the Toolbox killers, and this woman basically became really close with Bittaker to the point where, like, she was pregnant, went there pregnant, talked to him in prison while she was pregnant, and, like, showed pictures of her baby while she was was pregnant. I think she was like a crime reporter and an actual FBI analyst was like, this basically was saying this woman is not start from doing for doing that. The fact that she was pregnant and like getting close with this guy and she thinks that this man has changed shows just how dumb she is, basically.
Yeah. I find that to be very odd.
It's very odd and very, very stupid. Yeah. I think I didn't like the documentary because it's like you have no idea what he is telling the truth of and what he's not. Like, he on his deathbed he tried to tell her where the locations of other bodies were, where the bodies were that they couldn't find here. So that was just a side note because that kind of made me want to do this case. And then I watched that documentary and I was like, no, I'm not even going to touch on that because I don't like that. The fact that an FBI profiler is like, girl, what are you doing? You should not be trusting a serial killer and telling him about your baby and like going there 8 months pregnant.
Yeah, no.
That's just fucked up. But so yeah, Norris brought detectives to the area where they had disposed of the bodies and they were never found, the bodies of Schaefer and Hall. On February 9th of 1980, the skeletized bodies of Lamb and Gilliam were found at the bottom of a canyon along a dry riverbed. The bodies were scattered over an area measuring hundreds of feet in diameter. Okay, and then the ice pick was still lodged in the skull of Gilliam. The skull of Lamb had multiple indentations, which was blunt force trauma that was inflicted.
That's horrible. Wow, that's horrible.
So on February of 1980, Norris and Bittaker were both formally charged with the murders of 5 girls. At the arraignment, Bittaker was denied bail. Norris's bail was set at $10,000, which at the time of 1980, I don't know what that is, but it has to be like a pretty hefty amount nowadays.
Yeah.
Although I don't think he should have gotten bail. Within 1 month of being charged for murder, Norris accepted a plea bargain in which he would testify against Bittaker in return for the prosecution agreeing not to seek the death penalty against him.
Mm-hmm.
So he had this long game planned. Like, he knew what he was doing. So on March 18th of 1980, Norris pleaded guilty to 4 counts of first-degree murder and 1 count of second-degree murder in relation to Hall. 2 counts of rape, 1 count of robbery, and the formal sentencing was postponed until May 7th. In return to Norris's agreeing, or his plead, and to testify against Bittaker, prosecutors did agree to not seek the death penalty or life without parole at the upcoming sentencing. So finally, on May 7th of 1980, Norris was sentenced to 45 years to life in prison with eligibility of parole in 2010. So Norris's trial was pretty, like, I mean, it's a murder trial, but it wasn't really, like, there wasn't a lot of, like, pizzazz about it, I guess, if you want to call it that. Bittaker's trial was a different story. So his trial began on January 19th of 1981. He was tried before Judge Thomas Fredericks. For evidence against Bittaker, there were the Polaroid images taken of the facial expressions of Hall. Because if you remember, during those Polaroid images, Bittaker was the one making the girls walk up the hills and down naked and taking pictures while Norris was driving the van to see if there was someone coming or get alcohol or whatever. They talked about Bittaker wanting to rape and kill and torture while they were incarcerated as well. So the things that he had said while in prison were being brought up as like premeditation, basically. But the most damning evidence presented at Bittaker's trial was definitely a 17-minute section of the audio tape the pair created during Ledford's abuse and torture. The audio tape, which was found inside Bittaker's van, and Norris had earlier testified Bittaker had repeatedly played as he drove in the weeks prior to his arrest, adding that Bittaker considered the contents to be, quote, real funny. That was presented as evidence. Prosecutor Stephen Kay forewarned the jury, for those of you who do not know what hell is like, you will find out. Judge Fredericks had earlier denied motions by the defense to admit the tape recording from admission as evidence, but like, obviously you need that as evidence.
Yeah.
More than 100 people were present in the courtroom as the tape was played, and many members of both the jury and the audience openly cried upon hearing the tape, with several members of the audience either burying their heads in their hands, dabbing tears from their eyes, or just rushing out of the courtroom before the tape had finished. Bittaker was undisturbed at hearing the tape and smiled throughout the duration of the recording.
Oh.
In one of two instances throughout the trial, prosecutor Stephen Kay he began crying. He walked out of the courtroom during recess following the hearing of the recording of Ledford. While crying, Kay stated to the reporters gathering outside of the courtroom, he said, "Everybody who has heard that tape has had it affect their lives. I just picture these girls, how alone they were when they died."
Yeah.
So one question by reporters whether the audio tape should have been introduced into evidence, given the obvious psychological and emotional trauma caused. He said, "You're darn right. The audio tape should have been. The jury needs to know what these guys did." Which, yeah, it's evidence.
Yes. Yeah.
On February 15th, Bittaker testified on his own behalf. He denied any knowledge of the abduction of the murder of Schaefer and claimed that he paid Hall to pose for the pictures that were found at his hotel. He also said that he offered to pay Hall $200 for sex and she agreed. He then claimed that Norris had walked Hall into the San Gabriel Mountains before returning home and informing Bittaker that he had told Hall to just find her own way home. So he was trying to place the blame on Norris. Bittaker had a similar explanation as to the double murder of Lamb and Gilliam. He claimed that Gilliam accepted an offer of money for sex and posing for pictures, and that he last seen the girls alone with Norris in the van. When it came to the murder of Ledford, he claimed that she agreed to theatrically scream for the tape recorder and that she was not tortured in his presence, but she had been left alone with Norris, so he blamed Norris for the torture. On March 24th, the jury decided that Bittaker was guilty. He's formally sentenced to death. In the event that the sentence imposed was ever reverted to life in prison, Judge Thomas Frederick said the alternative sentence was 199 years, 4 months imprisonment to take immediate effect. So he was in prison for 4 months, so that would be added. He already served 4 months. He has 199 more years to go.
Uh-huh.
So Bittaker, like we kind of had mentioned, did a lot of death row interviews following his conviction in 81, never expressed a single drop of remorse for the crimes, repeatedly stating that the only remorse he felt had been for the fact that he and Norris were arrested, which ruined his own life.
Wow, that's really selfish.
Mm-hmm. Psychos. So Norris became eligible for parole in 2009. Norris declined to attend his parole hearing, so he automatically deferred his parole eligibility for another 10 years. He was then denied parole in 2019. So Stephen Kay, the prosecutor at Bittaker's trial, still considers the murders committed by them as the worst criminal case he has ever prosecuted or encountered, and remained insistent in his belief that prior to Bittaker's death, so Bittaker died, he had been more deserving of being executed than any other inmate incarcerated in California's death row. In interviews, he stated that for over 2 years following the trial, his sleep was disturbed by reoccurring nightmares in which he would be rushing to Bittaker's van to prevent harm coming to the girls, but he would, quote, always get there too late in his nightmares.
Mm-hmm.
Paul Bynum, the chief investigator of the murders committed by the guys, he ended up committing suicide in December of 1987. He was 39 years old. In a 10-page suicide note, Bynum specifically referred to the murders committed by Bittaker and Norris as haunting him and of fear, and of his fear they may be released from prison.
Oh, wow.
The audio tape Bittaker and Norris created for themselves raping and torturing Ledford remains in possession to this day by the FBI. It's in the FBI Academy. It is now used to train and desensitize FBI agents to the raw reality of torture and murder. So Bittaker died while incarcerated on death row at San Quentin State Prison on December 13th, 2019. He was 79 due to natural causes. Norris passed away on February 20th, 2020, so a couple months later at the age of 72 while in prison in California as well. And that is the Toolbox Murders.
Wow. That was pretty intense.
It is. This is a true crime podcast, and that's true crime. And
that is true crime.
And it is That is true crime. That is,
yeah.
It was a difficult one to research. But I feel like, you know, why do we listen to true crime? We listen to true crime, one, because we need to know what's out there and we need to know what to look out for. Like, I know I listen to true crime and research it because I want to know what other people have gone through and what happened in their circumstance and be like, okay, so that happened. How can I work to avoid that situation? Or what can I do to protect myself should I be in a situation like that? How can I be the most aware and prepared?
Yeah.
And on top of like preparing yourself physically, being able to defend yourself, like just knowing this stuff, like, I don't know.
Right. Just knowing how other killers, like different types of killers, like how they operate, like things that they say, they're like, you know, methods of doing, like their steps of like how these people, you know, like tested things out and, you know, tweaked things along the way for their whole sick plan or whatever.
Yeah. It's very scary. It's very, very scary. So yeah, Stranglers, thank you for hanging in there with us on this one. I know it was a really, really heavy one. Maybe next week we do a bit of a lighter one.
Yeah, I was thinking maybe I'll do a survivor story.
Ooh, I survived. Look up some episodes of I Survived. We had someone, I don't know who they were. So if you guys notice, if you go onto Spotify, we now have the option to put in like questions like, hey, what would you like to see on our next episode, or polls and stuff like that. One of you requested Jack the Ripper. So you wanted it for, I'm sorry, listener, you wanted it for Halloween, but we already recorded our Halloween episode, which was Chevy Tahoe. But maybe we'll do Jack the Ripper coming up.
Yeah.
I think that'd be a good one. That'd be a good one. Everyone knows Jack the Ripper is lighthearted crime. At this point.
Just because it's like an old-timey classic true crime.
It's a classic.
Yeah.
Okay, guys. Well, thank you so much for listening, and we appreciate you, and we love you, and don't forget to hit us up on our social medias, and go ahead and give us that 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts. Leave us a review. And we will chit chat with you next week.
Bye, everyone.